So this is kind of an interesting transitional time, and so for me also then it's good to get rooted in the basics, and so that's what this text for me is. And let me talk about it a little bit on sort of an overview level, and maybe just make a few points about it, and then as we go through the next series of meetings, I'll address each of the mindfulnesses in sequence with some greater degree of attention to the extent that I can, and that I can share with you what I've learned and practiced with and what my understanding is about what these things mean. And I hope it'll help you, because sometimes, you know, Buddhism can seem amazingly complicated. Loy and I were talking about this yesterday morning. We had breakfast, Kayla, Loy, and myself. And I said, Buddhist teachings are kind of interesting. And actually, I didn't realize the trueness of the image at the time. I said, you know, Buddhist teachings are like, you know, this like filigree, complicated, you know, sort of thing. This, you know, and you look at this complicated filigree pattern, and what you see is it creates a circle. And then you look at it and say, oh, it's just a circle. It's so simple. There's nothing complicated there at all. What's all this complication about drawing this circle? And it's actually very hard to just identify that circle. And so the complications are sometimes required. And then it's like, oh, this is ridiculously simple. And it's makes you wonder what all the hullabaloo was about. But it's just the way it is, because our minds are complicated. We have to go through this crazy process of feeding our complicated minds to see this absolute simple truth about things. So five stanzas is pretty simple, but it incorporates the whole of Buddhist practice over 2,500 years and stacks of volumes that would reach the ceiling of this room and go all the way to the window. And you know, it's like that. But what that means is that, you know, you can approach it with simplicity or you can approach it with complexity. And if the teacher has really deep experience and understanding, they will communicate it with clarity and it will seem very simple. Well, His Holiness did that, which is why I was so struck with it. I don't think I'll be able to do that, of course, but I'll try and share with you some of what I've learned. And hopefully it'll help you integrate your own practice and what you're about, because some of you have been practicing for a while, and so that'll be helpful. And if you're just starting to practice, or if you feel like your practice is a new practice, it'll help you to, in a very simple way, have some context to understand how do these pieces fit together. Instead of having this huge, complex kind of pattern thing to work on, it's like, well, how does this fit with that, and why do they say the other thing? You don't have to worry about that. You can just hold the pieces together. So I'm really grateful that he, in his usual amazing way, just sort of like picked the kind of the essential point and just there it was. And, you know, it's also interesting to wonder how it was that I managed to miss it for 30 years, but there it is. So the four mindfulnesses are one stanza for each of the first three mindfulnesses, and I'm not going to read them. I'm just going to do the highlights. And then two stanzas for the last mindfulness, and I'm going to explain what each of the first three are and then why two stanzas for the fifth. And that, just a little bit of detail, and then I think that's probably enough for the evening. So the first thing is mindfulness of the guru. That's the first mindfulness. And mindfulness of the guru, for us, it would be mindfulness of our own personal teacher, or mindfulness of the Dalai Lama, who's also our teacher. But it could be mindfulness of Shakyamuni Buddha, because Shakyamuni Buddha is sort of the great archetypal guru. And in all cases, what the guru really represents is the essence of your own awakened or enlightened nature, which you're disconnected from, which you're unfamiliar with, because you live at the surface rather than the depth of yourself. So to understand what your own depth really is and looks like, you have to see it outside of yourself. There's nothing about anybody in this room that is fundamentally different than the Dalai Lama. Nothing. nothing whatsoever. It's just he's more in touch with the depth of what he is than any of us can even imagine. But that's the difference. It's the difference is what he is in relationship with. It's not what he is as such. Of course, Tibetans wouldn't like me saying that too much because they see him as a Buddha. But if you really press them, they'd say, yeah, okay, that is true. I mean, essentially, it sounds a little disrespectful would be the issue. But it really is true. The essence of what all the great teachers are, including Shakyamuni Buddha himself, is not any different to what any of us are. And that's one of the really remarkable things about the Buddhist view of reality. It's not a religious view which is, here's us and our, you know, we're nothing, and then here's this great something someplace else which is everything, and, you know, we can't really aspire to anything more than devotion to it. The Buddhist view is total equality of everything in existence. Caterpillars with black stripes around their necks, no different than the rest of us, all beings equal. It's just that some beings are not more equal, they're just more aware of what's going on. They're more awake to what's going on. And the Buddhas are particularly awake. They know what's really going on. So in Guru Yoga, the guru is simply the external image, if you will, or icon of oneself in a form that's understandable. So you get around the Dalai Lama and you know you're around something totally remarkable. Right, I mean, you have to be dense as a rock to not notice that. But what we don't notice is that we're all something equally remarkable, which is therefore what our practice is. So when we're mindful of the guru in the way the text talks about it, I'm belaboring the point, but it's important. When we're mindful of the guru in the way the text talks about it, really it's a matter of being mindful of our own highest nature, if you will, or our own deepest self, which is always there with us. We just disconnected from it. And this is a way of connecting with it in an external form. So that's the essence of mindfulness of the guru. And that's where everything starts, because the guru, in a sense, represents the goal. This is what we're practicing to become. Not necessarily practicing to become a guru, but practicing to wake up. And the guru is more awake. Just as a side note, when missionaries first got to Tibet, they gave the Tibetans a really hard time for worshiping their gurus, their lamas. They called Tibetan Buddhism Lamaism, to be insulting, right? Because it was all about, you know, these people worshiping these lamas and what's the big deal here, because they didn't understand, you know, because they had a certain view of reality. They couldn't understand what was going on. And what was going on was actually quite profound. You just have to have a different psychological view of the process. Now, the second mindfulness here in the text is called the mindfulness of the altruistic aspiration to highest enlightenment, which is a big mouthful. But what the second mindfulness is about what we call altruism, and that's how it's translated here. And the way the Tibetans present it is along the lines of, when you begin to really see what's going on around you and you realize the condition that all beings are in, if you have any real sensitivity for that, it becomes intolerable. When you really begin to see what's going on around you and the pain that people are in, it's intolerable. And because it's intolerable, you feel deeply that you yourself must do something to help others. And so that's called altruistic aspiration. That's the way the Tibetans describe it, and I think that that's a challenge for us to accept things from that point of view. I mean, intellectually, I think we can do that if we think about it, but emotionally, I think that that's more of a radical issue. So the way I tend to present this idea of altruism is that when you understand that what the Lama or the Guru is yourself expressed externally, and that there's no difference between you and the Lama, and then it dawns on you one day that there's also no difference between fundamentally you and anybody else. I mean, once you get that there's no fundamental difference between you and one other person, it's not a big leap to understand that fundamentally there's no difference between you and anybody else. I mean, we're all different, of course. But at core, we're all the same. And when that dawns on you, then you begin to want to have a different kind of relationship with other people. And to me, that's really where altruism comes from. You know, so when somebody does something nasty to you, you can get angry and pissed off, and Kay certainly knows I can, because there's been some issue that I've been ranting about for the last week. But so, you know, I'm no saint here telling you these things, but these are at least intellectually things that I understand. So at your best, let's phrase it that way, at your best, you can look at that person, and instead of getting angry, you might, but maybe 5 minutes later, it's kind of like, what is it that is so hurtful, that is so painful for them, that is creating such a source of unhappiness in them that they would act this way, and that I'm really the vehicle for a problem that they're having within themselves, that they're expressing in relationship with me. And it's not about they're bad or anything like that, and it's also not about I'm going to get angry or get even. It's more like, we're all in this together, and I understand this very deeply, and so I understand where that hostility came from that other person, and I'm not going to send it back to them, because there's no virtue in my biting my own finger, if you will, right? So that's sort of, I think, a good way to think about altruism in this sense. Now, altruism is what is distinctive. This altruistic aspiration is one of the things that's distinctive about Mahayana Buddhism anyway. I think maybe you can say it's distinctive about Buddhism, but certainly about Mahayana Buddhism. And it goes deeper than what I'm talking about, but in particular, the Buddhists will say, if you only practice for yourself, you don't get very far, because what you're doing is practicing for me as being different from everybody else. And so you're reinforcing separation, and that's not going to get you very far. But if your intention is to practice, as they say, for the benefit of all beings, which sounds unbelievably inflated, what they're really saying is you're practicing for beings, including yourself. You're not practicing for yourself and to hell with everybody else. That's really all it comes down to. But if you don't get that turn of mind somehow, it limits your practice, because there's always a subtle level of reinforcing separation and otherness. And you can make a lot of progress even if you hold that point of view, but ultimately it can't get you as far as you could go. So I'll talk more about altruism another time. I mean, there are some recordings about this that are already, you know, on the website, but I'll come back to it. But there's the sort of the context for you. So that's the second mindfulness, guru and altruism. So that sort of orients the practice to, you know, remembering that the guru is what you can best be. It's your deepest self. The guru is your deepest self. That you, in forging your relationship with the guru, as in forging your relationship with your deepest self, you realize your deep interconnections with all beings, because they're not fundamentally different from you or the guru. If you and the teacher, well, I've already been over that territory, so I don't have to do that again. Third mindfulness is mindfulness of your body as a divine body. The distinctive thing about Tibetan practice is working with images. And, you know, in Zen, they say you just assume the posture and pay attention to your breath and let everything else go. The Tibetan tradition is much more along the lines of if you really are a Buddha and you're really not different from the guru or lama, and you're going to practice that truth, how are you going to do that? Because what you're going to do constantly is feel I, as if it's just I, this little me, and that you have this self-concept, and you constantly fall into that self-concept. So how do you step out of that self-concept in your practice to make your practice efficacious? Well, if you really are, in your deepest nature, Buddha nature, if you do have a Buddha nature, what does your deepest nature look like? If you're going to make it look like something, of course, it's formless. That's one of the problems with your deepest nature. You can't draw a picture of it too easily and say, there it is, and I recognize it. But on the other hand, you can. It looks like a Buddha. That's why the Buddha looks the way it looks. So this mindfulness of your body as a divine body is a technique of saying, yeah, really, in essence, I am a Buddha. I'm just so forgetful that I keep forgetting that I'm a Buddha. Like, every second of every day, I keep forgetting that I'm a Buddha. So how do I help myself remember that I'm a Buddha? Oh, I adopt an image of myself as a Buddha, whatever Buddha I happen to like. Green Tara, okay, you're a green woman, Buddha. You know, Vajrasattva, you're a white guy, Buddha. I mean, whatever, you know, whatever you like. It doesn't make any difference, really, because they're all kind of limited visions of yourself, although each has its own virtue in terms of transformation, and they are different, but in essence, they're all the same, which is yourself as a Buddha. So you, remembering yourself as the divine body is like, this is the body of a Buddha. I mean, I know it looks like a 66-year-old college professor who could use a shave, but essence of what I am is a Buddha. And so this helps me remember that. And that reinforces the altruistic aspiration. We're all Buddhas, because deep inside there's a green Tara over here and over here. And there's a Lama over here and over here, which the green Tara takes the form of the Lama takes the form of the green Tara. So then all these things reinforce each other. So those are the first three mindfulnesses. Now the fourth mindfulness is mindfulness in the view of emptiness, as it's translated here, which is interesting. It doesn't say mindfulness of the view of emptiness, but mindfulness in the view of emptiness. And what this means is, one of the things that's distinctive about Buddhism is this concept that gets translated as emptiness, and that leads to all kinds of confusions and problems. But the basic idea is that when you understand what's actually going on around you, when you wake up, to use that term, that's the alternative to enlightenment. So in Tibetan, the word for Buddha, Sangye, actually means awaken and increase, two things together. It means increase of awakeness. That a Buddha is the person who has awakened to the maximum degree. So what is it that you see or know when you wake up from the dream that we're all in, which is that we're not Buddhas, that we're separate from each other, and that if I get mine and you don't get yours, I'm better off, that kind of thing. What is it that we see when we see what's really going on? Well, we know that all the world around us is empty of our projections on the world. Okay, that everything we experience and interact with based upon certain sets of assumptions and preconditioned ideas, whether they're cultural, whatever the case may be, and we fill our experience with our ideas about what's actually going on. Now, those of us who have lived long enough pretty much have figured out that what's actually going on and what we think is going on is usually not the same thing. But on a moment-by-moment basis, we don't remember that. It's like we don't remember that we're Buddhas, right? On a moment-by-moment basis, I'm quite sure I know what's going on, and it doesn't take too many moments for the world, if I'm paying attention, to tell me I don't have a clue what's going on, right? But emptiness, the concept of emptiness, is the Buddhist way of talking about our experience is empty or devoid of our ideas about what's actually going on. Now, of course, there's a problem with that, and the problem is that our ideas about what's actually going on, which are to a certain extent not true or real at all, function very usefully for doing things like driving your car to work, dealing with a Department of Motor Vehicles when you need to get a new license. You know, I mean, we're very adept at negotiating a certain practical world. So this idea that the world isn't what we think it is can sort of sound like a problem. And so Buddhists don't mean to reject that kind of practical dimension of what's happening. But what they do say is that it doesn't go deep enough into the reality, that there's the superficial level of what's happening, And then there's the deepest level of what's happening. And the deepest level of what's happening is the recognition that we've mentally constructed the world we're in because it's a nice practical thing to have done, even if it's not entirely true. It still serves us relatively well. Not perfectly well, but relatively well. Right? So the deepest level of understanding is that our experience is empty of what it appears to be. Now, this is really very profound, and I'm not going to be able to make it totally clear in just a few lines. Maybe the Dalai Lama can do that, but I think even he would have trouble with that. So what the fourth mindfulness is about is how do you approach the truth of what's going on when you're meditating versus how do you approach the truth of what's going on in daily life? And that's why there are two stanzas that are associated with the fourth mindfulness. One is mindfulness of what you do when you're meditating, and one is mindfulness of what you do when you're not meditating. And when you're meditating, the mindfulness is all about not believing anything that presents itself to you, which is perfectly okay, because you're sitting on a meditation cushion in a little sort of safe space. You don't have to negotiate the world. And all the thoughts that show up, you can look at and think to yourself, well, that's a pretty interesting thought. Boy, that is a really obsessive mind you have there, David, you know, and really focus on that kind of thing. Or why are you worried about that? Or, you know, that's very interesting. Where did that habit pattern come from? Or, you know, whatever. And you can sort of spend your time looking at what's going on internally instead of being caught by it. And then there's the mindfulness of what you do when you're off the meditation cushion, which is you've got to pay attention to the traffic rules so you can drive your car to work. You know, if you're meditating really deeply when you're driving your car, the odds are you're going to have a conversation with your insurance agent. You know, I mean, you can't really be at that level. But you can remember that things aren't truly what they appear to be. And so the metaphor that the Tibetans have for that is to remember that the world is like a magic show. In ancient days, at the crossroads of various roads between different little towns, a conjurer or a magician would show up and he would set up his little act. And he would conjure up, they would say, horses and elephants in the air and so on and so forth. And the magician, of course, knows that the horses and elephants that are floating in the air are not real at all. But all the folks who are walking down the road who walk upon this show, they see horses and elephants floating in the air. And it's like, wow, how does he get the horses and elephants to float in the air? So the Buddhists say we should be like the magician, not like the folks on the road. You know, the folks on the road think that this is just all there is. It's totally real. There's nothing else. This is just what it is. But the magician knows that it's not quite what it appears to be. It appears to be just what it is, but there's something else going on. Might not be in the mode of seeing it as like a big fantasy bubble, but just in the back of the mind is like, this isn't quite what's really going on. Which is then kind of a useful attitude, because among other things, when, you know, you're grouchy, whatever, person down the hall, colleague, gives you a hard time, it's kind of like, okay, here comes my reaction. What's really going on here? You know, it might just give you a little space to stand back. Now, the thing about these two conditions of the view of the emptiness of what's going on the meditation cushion, versus the view of emptiness of what's going on when you're sort of in daily life, actually influence each other. And that's the interesting thing about this. When you practice long enough and deeply enough on the meditation cushion to see through things, the notion that the horses and elephants floating in the air aren't real comes naturally, more and more naturally as time goes on.
Or that you're creating them.
Comes more and more naturally as time goes on. Thank you. And similarly, as that happens more frequently, it reinforces your ability to see through things deeply while you're sitting on the meditation cushion. So the experiences bleed into each other over time. And so then what awakening is, what enlightenment is when you know you're a Buddha, that you're in relationship with all the other Buddhas around here, that you care about them, that you want to help them, that the way you do it is to remember yourself to be a Buddha by visualizing yourself as a Buddha, and in doing so, you recognize the magic act of your own creation of this world while it's happening, so you can change the magic act and make it a better magic act. And that's the way you benefit the world from the Buddhist point of view. That's what the deepest altruism is. Because now your magic act is not horses and elephants floating in the air, but your magic act is going through the world in your daily life as a good, caring person that helps the folks that are around. And even if you don't do a whole lot actively to do something like that, you know, you're making some kind of effort to be clear in a world that's completely confused, and that in itself is a benefit to what's going on, would be the Buddhist view. So those are the four mindfulnesses, and that's the way in which one can practice. That's the whole of practice as the Tibetans understand it in a nutshell right there.